Welcome to season two of Beyond Beauty. I'm so excited. Where I talk with visionary artists who share their journeys, influences, and creative processes. My name is Jacqueline Cofield, and I research and study artistic praxis. This season brings together a wonderful and diverse lineup of voices, artists whose roots and cultural backgrounds shape the art they bring to the world. Each conversation reveals not just the artwork, but the personal and collective narratives that inspire it. Join me as we explore the intricate blend of heritage, creativity, and purpose that defines these remarkable women artists. Today, we have the incredible Rugyatu Yalo with us. I'm particularly excited to learn about her journey from Sweden to the US, her self-taught techniques. We'll also discuss her studio practices, the importance of mentorship, and the role of her transcultural identity in shaping her artistic vision. Let's get started. Good afternoon, Rugyatu Yalo. I'm so excited to have you today. I know it's morning for you, it's afternoon for me. I'm so excited to have you today here on Beyond Beauty. Thank you for being here.
Yeah, hi. Thank you so much for having me. I'm super excited.
I've had such joy just researching you, learning about your practice. I'm so fascinated. I'm so excited to just say this in the beginning. I would normally say this in the end, but I'm so excited to like follow you and your journey. And yeah, so we're meeting digitally, but who knows, maybe one day we'll be in the same room.
Exactly. Yes. I love New York. So I do come pretty often. I don't know if I'm going to come much this year, but I do come by that way.
I'm also an alum. I went to grad school at the University of Southern California. So I'm a Trojan. So I did spend some time in LA. It's been a minute since I've been out there, but I definitely need to make it back out. So, but I'm sure we're having some good weather now, but maybe I'll need to come out there in the winter.
Yeah.
So I always like to start with just understanding how you come to this place of being an artist. Can you tell us about your artistic journey and what brought you to fine art?
Yeah, so I've always painted since I was a kid. My mom is a painter, not professionally. And my grandma was also a painter and she did sculptures and weaving, also not professionally, but both of them incredible artists. So I grew up painting. I've loved painting since I was a kid. But growing up in Sweden, I never thought that was a possibility to actually pursue that. Like that wasn't even presented to me as an opportunity. So I knew I wanted to pursue art. I just didn't know in what way, because in my head, I thought, okay, if I pursue art, I'm going to end up homeless. Like that was my idea of like...
Oh no, that's a narrative over there too.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Oh yeah. It's just, when it comes to creative side, like they have a lot of creative outlets in Sweden in school, but they don't necessarily push that idea of like that you can actually pursue that as a career. So like I said, that's why I never thought that was a possibility. So I moved out here. And I continued school. So I just came as an international student to the States. And once I graduated, which was like 2015, a lot of my friends, and actually an ex-boyfriend of mine, really encouraged me to pursue art because I would paint on the side. I would paint every weekend. I was painting, you know, like I love painting. It's my happiness.
Painting what? Like,
I always painted women.
And what were you were doing? What were you doing with these? And what were your mom? You said she was painting not professionally. What were they doing with their paintings? Putting them up in the house?
Yeah, my mom had an interesting. So she predominantly painted self-portraits of herself or landscapes. So they would be different, like a lot of colorful self-portraits, or she would do landscapes. That's what she would focus on. And then my grandma, she would paints all sort of things, but specifically also just portraits of herself or family members. And she played a lot around with surrealism, some really amazing work. I'm still so fascinated. She used she also played around with the batik, you know, like the color. I'm still a little confused to how she did that, but but she's incredible. Oh my God, I'm obsessed with the work still.
So was there work like adorning your house? When you were growing up, did you grow up in an environment with their work surrounding you?
Actually, not in my mom's house. So I grew up with my dad and my stepmom, both of them Gambian. but I would go visit my mom on holidays, like, you know, spring break, summer break. I would spend with my mom, and she lives on the countryside in Sweden, like on this island right next to Sweden called Gotland. So I would go there. Me and my twin sister would go there. But my mom didn't necessarily have a lot of art, but she's like a little hippie, like almost like a nature person. So it was a lot of things related to nature and a lot of books. Like her whole house is just filled with books. It's like a library. She loves reading, and she would educate us a lot about nature and all sorts of things. But it was more so when we would go to our grandma's house, she would have her, you know, little sculptures everywhere, and her art would be up. So I would see it more so there.
What about in school when you're growing up? Were you exposed to the arts?
In school, we did have, I remember this was like later, I think maybe like in eighth grade or maybe seventh grade. It wasn't until then that I took like an art class. And I was so excited because my teacher was amazing. And I didn't like to do the assigned work because I don't know, I almost felt like I didn't like to be controlled in what I needed to paint. But he would kind of give me free range and let me paint whatever. And he was super encouraging. That was definitely one of my favorite classes. But that was the only class I took. Other than that, I wasn't really exposed to art like that. I would just paint all the time. I was that person that was just like sketching during class. Like I was called the daydreamer. I even, you know how you get awards in school? Like, oh, the class clown. I was the daydreamer every single time because I'll just disappear. Painting or drawing, like that's all I did all the time.
You were probably making sense of the environment around you and using your art as a conduit for your learning, probably. That's what I like to think.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever really thought about that. I honestly, when growing up, I thought there was something wrong with me because I was so like, oh, just, you know, just spaced out and just, you know, I think I just wasn't really exposed to a lot of creative people around me. So I didn't really understand myself or what was going on or, you know, anything like that.
So then it was pretty courageous for you to decide to come to the U.S. and study arts. Can you talk about that?
So at first, it wasn't even the thought of, oh, I'm going to go to the U.S. to study arts. It was just like, okay, I'm going to go to the U.S. because I need to change my environment. I didn't like the weather in Sweden. And I was almost desperate to leave Sweden because of the weather. I love Sweden to death, but the weather, you know.
What's the weather like?
It's cold 75% of the year. And the winters, it gets so dark because we don't have much sunlight. So you automatically get very depressed. And it's very hard for me to handle that. Like, I definitely go through stages of depression during the winter time. So as soon as I graduated, I was already set on going somewhere else to study. And I was going to go to Australia first, but I met some people in Stockholm that were from LA that convinced me to come to the States, to LA. And yeah, they basically sold me on that. And then I moved here. I tried to figure out what I was going to study because, like I said, I wanted to study art, but I didn't think that was a career, like, that wasn't something I could pursue. So I went with first with graphic design, which I did not enjoy. And then I ended up with computer animation, which I did love. I loved computer animation. So
I took a computer animation class in undergrad. Oh gosh, that was so hard. It was so hard.
It is tough. But I don't know. I think because to me personally, like you're drawing, you know, if it's for a movie or something like that, like you're drawing something and that got me excited about it. It's on the computer, you know?
So you've traveled and lived in so many different places. And I'm wondering if you could speak to the impact of travel or place on your work.
Yeah. So I would say it would more so be in these later years because prior to that, I would just paint wherever I felt like painting. And I did have a focus. I've always had a focus on painting women. That's always been my outlet. I've always been about, you know, women empowerment. And, you know, my mom is like a heavy feminist. You know, she's been she's ingrained that the importance of equality at a very early age. So that was something that was like very heavy influence in my work already. And then with my dad being a very proud African, West African, that kind of influenced what I was painting as well. So basically, it wasn't until I would say these last few years that I started traveling around the States that I feel like my work got influenced by travel. I think it's always been very influenced by my culture, my identity and all that. But when it comes to traveling, I would say it's more so in the later years, because I started getting more fascinated by architecture and kind of like the history behind architecture when it comes to like gender politics within architecture. Mm-hmm. That has started to influence my work, especially lately after I went to New York and did my art residency there at the Mac Art Foundation. That kind of opened up my eyes to the conversations within that, because I've always been very fascinated by European classical architecture, but I don't think I never really thought about like what the dynamic of placing biracial woman in front of these buildings represents, or what the story behind that could be, or even like the dynamic between the two. So I would say it's more so lately, yeah, especially when I went to New York, that I started, yeah, exploring that more.
So I've read and listened to you talk about how your technique is largely self-taught. And so I was wondering if you could talk about your strategies around layering and mixing colors. I'm particularly interested in this because my last class here in my doctoral program, I decided to take a studio painting class. So I have entered into the world of mixing colors, and it is hard. So I'm wondering if you could talk about how you develop these techniques, and particularly of layering and mixing colors, and how what that means for your work.
Yeah, that is an interesting topic, because I am still learning when it comes to that, and I'm still exploring and having fun with it. I think I've never, at the beginning, especially before I kind of stepped into the fine art world, I was very intimidated by colors. So there was one point where I was playing around with a lot of blue hues. But other than that, I was so intimidated by colors. So when I started painting, and when my focus was painting Black women specifically, this was late 2000. When my focus was on that, I would predominantly just paint in grayscale. And I would, I started incorporate like maybe one color into the clothing, maybe one bright red or something like that. But other than that, I think colors have always intimidated me, because I wasn't taught how to mix or how to play around with layers or anything like that. Like, I didn't go to school for art. So I think there was a lot of things that I didn't know that made me feel intimidated. But once I got the studio here in LA, which was end of 2021, and that's when I essentially say that I got my foot in the door in the fine art world, because that's when I also landed like my first solo show and everything with Costial in Sweden. But I think that's what I got more pushed into exploring colors and pushing myself beyond what I, you know, felt comfortable with. So even then, honestly, I would ask friends or people that I've gotten to know, artists, about colors, especially because I've moved back into oil paint. I hadn't used oil paint since I was like maybe 13 or something, because my mom had given me some oil paint. But ever since then, I hadn't really used it. So I didn't really know anything about mixing mediums or like creating the right colors. And so I would ask around and I would Google. And honestly, I'm still doing that.
Well, yeah, I'm glad to hear that, because I felt I had to really practice patience and humility as I was mixing colors. I wasn't expecting that would be part of that experience, but it's pretty intense. I mean, it just made me appreciate the artist craft so much more, which is why I took the studio class, because I wanted to sort of put on the shoes and see what it's like to paint.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, for me personally, like, I'm very patient and I enjoy the process. So every learning stage, it's so much fun for me. So I don't think I ever necessarily feel frustrated if I don't understand, you know, certain color combinations or anything. Like, everything is exciting because I'm still learning. And I think that's a great thing about being an artist.
I'm super curious about your studio practice. Are there certain conditions that you need to get in the flow of things?
So I have different ways that I maneuver in the studio. But I will say the one thing that really gets me like hyped up, because I like being hyped up when I paint, like energetic, because at times you can be really exhausted in the studio. Just play Afrobeat. Like, I love Afrobeat. It's my happiness. I grew up on Gambian, Senegalese music, and, you know, also growing up in Sweden at a very early age, they were playing Afrobeat already out there. So I've grown up on Afrobeat. So that is like my happiness. And as soon as I start playing that, I'm like energized and I'm ready and I get excited about this new piece that I'm about to paint. So that is definitely my go-to, especially when I need energy. But other times, honestly, I'll listen to podcasts if it's informative ones when it comes to like healing or if it's a crime podcast. So it just depends on the mood, I would say. But especially when I'm tired, I need some Afrobeat.
And is there a particular time of the day?
I am a night owl, 100%. But I am pushing myself to be more of a day worker. And so I do try to go, I get up early in the morning to like go to the gym and then go about my day with any errands that I need to run. And then I head to the studio. So depending on the day, I'm either in at like 2 p.m. or 4 p.m. And then I stay either late or I'll stay till latest 12, depending on, you know, how much work I need to put in. But I could work all night. I love working all night, but it's just...
But you need the Afrobeats, right? You need the Afrobeats to get you going all night or...
You know what's interesting? I more so need a daytime because daytime, I'm not a focused person. I'm just, it's very hard for me to focus during the day. So I need a daytime. But at nighttime, I don't know what it is. I'm a night owl. I could be up all night and just paint. But I just don't like getting up. I don't want to sleep throughout the day. That's the only reason I don't do that.
I'm very interested after this to, if you could share your playlist with me, because I I love to explore the playlists of artists that they use in their studio practice. And this came up in my dissertation research, actually, the role of the sonic environment. And I recently have gotten into Amapiano. So now I almost feel like I can't like get through my day without Amapiano at some point. Yeah. Okay. So you've mentioned having mentors, and I was wondering if you could talk about the role or importance of mentors in this artistic journey.
Yeah. So prior to 2021, which is, like I said, like when I got my studio and everything really kind of started moving for me, I didn't have any mentor of any sort. I would just ask questions. I would ask around about, you know, because I didn't know how things worked in the fine art world. I didn't know if my work was good enough or, you know, I didn't know anything. So I would just ask questions. But once I decided to, you know, take a leap of faith and get the studio, and I met Canyon, who's one of the artists at Mohilev Studios, which is where I have my studio. Mm-hmm. And he was actually the one that introduced me to the Swedish gallery, which is the one that I had my first solo show with. But he basically ended up mentoring me throughout that while I was preparing for the show. And he was the one that really pushed me to explore, you know, colors and explore what I really wanted to do with my work. Like, what did my work mean to me? Where did I want to go with my work? And start asking more questions in regards to it. Because, like I said, prior to that, I would paint what I felt like painting, and I wanted to focus on women. I wanted to focus on the Black experience for women. But once he started opening up those questions for me, that's when I started thinking about, okay, what is my experience within art? And like, and that's when I kind of started diving deeper into the whole new theme, I guess I would say, of biracial women.
So I've heard you talk about the experience of self-doubt, which is something that we all experience. And I'm going to quote Frederick Douglass. I'm going to give a shout out to my hometown, Rochester, New York, where he lay. Frederick Douglass once said, "Without struggle, there is no progress." So I'm wondering if you can speak to how struggle and particularly self-doubt, how that fuels your journey as an artist. And also, I'm interested to hear you discuss how your transcultural identity has played a role in overcoming some of these self-doubt and struggles.
It's interesting because prior to me kind of stepping into the art world, like I said, in 2015, that's when my friends kind of encouraged me to pursue art and everything. And as soon as they encouraged me, it was almost like a light bulb just like, boom, just went up. I immediately just knew that this is where I'm going. This is where I'm going to do. And it's going to happen for me. Like, I don't know what I felt it in my like soul. Like, it's going to happen for me. I'm going to be able to pursue art. I just need to be patient and I need to just find my way. And so I just had this like belief in myself. I just knew, like, I didn't even have any fear about it. I don't know why. I wasn't scared to pursue it. And I just knew maybe it's going to take me 10 years. I don't know how long it's going to take, but it's going to happen for me. So I just need to figure out how do I need to go about it. So in the beginning, I felt like I moved without any type of fear. But once I started, and I, especially when I landed the first solo, I felt like I had more doubt because I definitely got the imposter syndrome. And, you know, I think I've, even moving to the States, I've gone through so much, like ups and downs. And especially after I graduated, I was struggling for a while. Like, I had no money. Even when I got the studio, I could not afford a studio. I couldn't even afford paying my rent. So I think once things started moving forward for me, it was almost like, wait, this can't be real. Like, I think it happened so quickly that I wasn't mentally prepared for it. So it was a little bit of a struggle for me. And I don't know if that necessarily helped me. I think what helped me was just talking to people and getting some reassurance of, like, you know, listen, this is the artistic journey. And, like, you need to step into whatever you're doing without worrying about what people are going to think. Like, just do your thing. And whenever you're enjoying the process and enjoying your craft, I feel like your best work comes out. And I think when you're worried about what other people think or what's going to happen or these pieces going to sell, your work is just not going to turn out good. And that was something I kind of had to learn. Even throughout this journey, I've had to learn that, because there has been ups and downs where I felt like, you know, I would have a lot of people come into my studio and give me advice or tell me this and that. And I will get a little bit insecure about my craft and wonder, like, am I going about this the right way? And then almost start listening to them, which didn't help me, because then I immediately felt like I didn't come out with some good work. And I think having a little bit of fear is, like, good and bad. I think that the imposter syndrome wasn't good for me at all. I don't know if that works for other people, but yeah, that didn't work well for me. I think that basically just gave me anxiety.
And that's something that women primarily experience, women and women of color, imposter syndrome.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And I mean, especially, I mean, I think any field you get into as a woman or a woman of color, you're going to experience that, because, you know, there's an inequality there. And I think even for me, being a biracial woman, stepping into the art world, I already felt like there was, like, very few women in this world that are pursuing art or that I could see that were doing well. I would see a lot of my male artist friends that would do really well and be supported. And I could clearly see a difference in how women and especially Black women were supported in the art, which was not very much there.
But I find it interesting how leaning into your identity helped you to navigate this space.
Yeah.
And I think, like, oftentimes when you're experiencing imposter syndrome, you're trying to figure out, like, what parts of yourself to amplify and to hide. And so I find in your practice, even your decisions to focus on hands and then to shift to gaze, like, these are related to your transcultural identity. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, of course. It's interesting because when I started on these pieces of work, I guess I hadn't really dived into my feelings, into how I felt growing up being a biracial woman until I started this work. And it felt intimidating, but also exciting at the same time. And I think the more I felt comfortable, the more I realized, like, oh, this is what I want to do, the more exciting it got, that I'm like, okay, I'm about to present to the world, like, you know, my identity, my story, which I know so many women can identify with, and men.
It seems to me that it does, that there's a pride and a consciousness that comes from your lived experience, not only as an international student, but growing up in Sweden, though in Sweden, having still a multinational, multiracial awareness, experience, and perspective. And so, yeah, I'm just curious about how the strength that you derive from this. When I hear you talk about imposter syndrome, which, I mean, we all have experienced it. Even in my doctoral journey, I have experienced that. And so as a woman of color myself, always thinking about this idea of imposter syndrome is also a question of belonging. And then, so it's like, how do you negotiate yourself out of that feeling?
Yeah, I think because I started thinking more, especially with this work, about my struggles with identifying or feeling like I don't necessarily belong to either or, when it comes to like my Swedish side and my Gambian side, you know, I think all of us as human beings, we all want to belong to something. We want to belong to a group of people or, you know, our friends or whatever. And I think once I started diving into these pieces, I started realizing more and more how much I've struggled with it and how much it affected me in a way where I always felt like I was the odd one out. And I think I've always thought I was a little bit weird or something, you know, because I'm a slightly antisocial at times or introverted. But I think also because I wanted to belong so badly. And I think a lot of times when you don't look like everybody else, there's always going to be this, I wouldn't say hesitation, but it's like, I would say everybody's inviting, but it's, you're still not one of us, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. So I think that was something I started realizing more and more, how much I felt that, like growing up in Sweden or even coming out here to the States, even being a, you know, essentially a Black woman, but from Europe coming to the States, I'm also not fitting in. And, you know, I have different values or different cultural aspects because I'm Swedish and Gambian. And so I think it's like, it's just a continuous pattern. I'm like, wow, I feel like this is something that should be brought up and brought into question about what it is to be biracial or come from two different cultures or whatever it is that so many people are experiencing. But I think one of the things I realized is that first and foremost, it's not that I have to be either or, like I'm only one thing, because mm-hmm. I felt like sometimes people wanted me to pick. Mm. Like, oh, no, but you're African. Like, okay, but I'm also Swedish. And I just, you know, finally came to the conclusion, like, no, it's okay. I'm 100% both. It's okay to say that without it being an issue, or, you know, I don't have to care what other people think. Like, that's how I feel within myself. And that's okay. And accepting that. And I think that I've always had a really strong sense of pride in where I'm from. And that definitely comes from my dad instilling that. He was at a very early age, making it very clear that he was a very proud Gambian and, you know, that we should be as well. And, you know, we're making sure we knew where we come from, that we knew our language, that we knew our culture, like our heritage, essentially.
Did you visit Gambia when you were younger?
Yeah. So we went when we were kids, like very little. And then we didn't go for several years, I'm assuming because of financial reasons. And then the first time we went back again, it wasn't until I was 16. And after that, yeah, we've been back. So that was amazing because we haven't been back since we were 16. And we went into the village because my grandpa was head chief of a tribe. He passed away a few years ago. And so now my dad kind of like took over. But when we went to visit, my grandpa was still alive. And we went in there and, you know, some of those people in the village, some of the kids had never seen somebody that was light skinned. So to them, they were like, oh, my God, it's a white person, or they thought it was a ghost. So some of the kids were scared of us because they thought we were ghosts, me and my twin sister. Mm-hmm. And it was a pretty incredible experience to, you know, because like I said, I hadn't been there since I was a kid. So just experiencing the village life and seeing my relatives there and also being in the city and everything. But I'm very happy that my dad made sure that we knew everything about our culture, that we knew our language, that, you know, I grew up in a very West African household. You know, we wore the clothes and we're going to certain parties or the traditional wears, and they watched Senegalese TV and then we listened to Senegalese and Gambian music at home and ate only Gambian food, you know.
So you had a community of Senegambians in Sweden.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. Oh, there's a whole community. And we're all relatives. That's what we say, you know. Oh, that's my cousin, you know. So, yeah, yeah. We're all very close. It's a very, like, close-knit community. Amazing community. So I have so many Gambian relatives.
I've always wanted to go to Sweden. I'll have to make it one day. But I love what you're saying about your travels to Gambia. I mean, I believe that, as Peter Tosh said, all Black people are African. And at some point, I feel like we all need to make a journey to the continent. And I have my own experience of being called Tubab when I was in Senegal.
Yes,
because I'm also very light presenting. So yeah, I feel you on that. Although nobody ever told me I was a ghost. Hopefully they weren't thinking.
Yeah, you have to go like deep into the villages for that. That's so funny. Yeah, Tubab. Yeah, they yell that after the car. Tubab, Tubab, Tubab.
White yes. Person. Yes, I love it. I love it. I was like, what's Tubab? And after I learned, I was like, what? Are you kidding me? But yeah, so, but these are experiences that are so important. I took my daughter to Senegal when she was 4 because I wanted her to know Africa from a young age because that's part of her heritage, you know? So I love that your dad was doing that. And I'm so happy to hear about these communities, the pockets of communities in Sweden. In response to this feeling that you had to choose, I will quote the words of Cardi B, I don't want to choose. I want both. And I love that you said that. And I was like, yeah, I mean, who said we got to choose? I love that reframing that you don't have to choose one part of your identity. It's all you. Yeah. So if you have to quote Cardi B in those instances, I'm sure she'll be happy. Many times quoted Cardi B in academia. Okay, so you talked about not relying or being attached to public perception around work. And I'm wondering about thinking about your Flag Art Foundation Spotlight series. Can you talk about what was rewarding in regards to sharing your work with a broader audience?
Yeah, I was approached by the Flag Art Foundation. I was actually really excited because of who they are and who they work with. And I've never done anything like a spotlight, you know, where you have one piece, literally, and everybody just comes in to see that one piece. So all together, it was a really good experience. They introduced me to a lot of people. They kind of broadened my view on just like the art world in general because of the people that they introduced me to and the conversations that were had. It was a really overall good experience. Glenn, the guy that I guess he's the head of the Flag Art Foundation. So I'm trying to figure out how I even met. I think I was approached through Instagram, to be honest. I think that's how we got connected. I'm trying to think how that even happened. But
oh, wow.
But yeah, this was like in 2022. Yeah, it was right after my my solo in Sweden. So it was a pretty big deal for me to work with them. Like I said, because of who they are and who they work with, and I wasn't expecting to work with them or somebody like them so early on in my career. So yeah, it was a great experience. It was a great experience.
Wonderful. As they're emerging young artists from grade school and up, can you talk about how educational institutions might better support cultivating young artists?
First and foremost, even just educating kids on like all these amazing artists that are out there. Like, yes, we know Picasso and, you know, all these people that passed away, but current contemporary artists are doing well, younger artists that are doing well that you can identify with, people, you know, of color, especially if you are of color yourself. Women, just anything and everything, because I didn't hear anything about that. I didn't know anything about any of the artists, or, you know, you get a little bit of art history in school, but that's about it. So I think that would be so helpful in just opening up your eyes into the opportunities of like, oh, that is something I can pursue, because now immediately you end up having some role models, somebody you can identify with, somebody that lives, somebody that's young and pursuing this. So I think that first and foremost would be amazing. I think that would have encouraged me 100% to pursue art. Oh my God, 100%. But also just like how things work, the difference between commercial art and fine art, like how things work to maneuver in the world, how to even get into that world, like all of that stuff. I think maybe there should be like a separate class specifically for that. I think it's cool and all that we're having, you know, an art class where people can go in and draw and paint, but maybe at least allow some of the students, if it's younger or older age, but at a young age, to like get the opportunity to also learn, if they do want to learn more about the art world, like those things, like what it really entails, I guess. Because like I said, I love that I had that class in what was the 7th or 8th grade. That was a art class and the teacher was amazing. But I would have loved if they also offered an opportunity to learn more for those that were really interested in art, aka me, educational wise and opportunity wise.
Your work is beautiful and portrays women with these complex identities who are underrepresented in art. And you use symbolism and color in certain specific ways. And I'm wondering if you could talk about the use of symbolism in your work and what you're hoping the encounter with your work will impart.
Yeah, so there's a lot going on with my work. But I mean, essentially the whole story, or my story of just being a biracial woman with all the different skin colors, you know, the representation of the black, the white, and the mix, you know, that very clear what that means, you know, or what it means to me, because it literally stands for, you know, my black heritage, my white heritage, and then me as a biracial woman. And I used to paint these like red lines that was supposed to represent the bloodline from the ancestors to the present day woman. And I wanted to incorporate that into my work. So I started incorporating threads instead that I glue on top of the skin colors, which is supposed to represent the connection between the races. And that is something that I wanted to be something that's very important to me, because like I said, even with the whole me realizing, like, you know what, it's not about picking or I'm 50-50, it's 100% both. And there's a connection between all of us. And I've had conversation where people feel some type of way towards, you know, maybe white people, or people feel some type of way towards black people. And I'm just like, we're all connected. Like, I need that to be very significant in my work, that we're all equal. But at the same time, also diving into what black people or biracial people have dealt with throughout the centuries. And that's kind of where those floating hands come into, because that's supposed to be the ancestral beings protecting these women and guiding these women. And that's why you have these hands sometimes holding the strings that are connected to these women. Or in the beginning, when I would cover their eyes, that was also a sense of protecting them. So when it comes to that, all of that is extremely important to me. That's going to continue in my work, because I had somebody ask me, like, okay, is this your signature? Is this what you're going to continue painting? And I'm like, yes, because this is me and this is my story. But I'm still going to play around with other aspects of it. Like when it comes to, you know, for example, the backgrounds, how I started to dive into gender politics. That is something that's also important to me and kind of exciting to dive into as well. And the colors that I use, that is also a very big aspect of who I am when it comes to the very bright colors as part of the skin tone, but also part of the clothing. That is always the first layer that I paint, and it's supposed to represent the nature and the love I have for nature and how connected we are to nature, especially us as women. I just continuously just like women, but you know, I just love us women.
The things my podcast is about women, so I'm with you on that.
We're like goddesses. We're able to give birth. Like there's so much to us that I just like admire and love, and I just want to celebrate that throughout my work. So it's a celebration, also an exploration, like within, you know, like my identity, but also what I love that other people can identify with this. I think that's the most important aspect of it, that there's so many other people that can identify to my work in so many different ways, if it's race or culture or ethnicity or whatever it is, you know. So yeah, I love that.
Yeah. And that brings a sense of like aliveness to your work for me. And I really appreciate how you're really creating these visual vocabularies that we can engage in, these processes of encoding and decoding. And so I teach a class on literacies, and I think about visual literacies and all of these things. And so, yes, this has been really great. So we're going to close with thinking about what's exciting you now, something that you're excited about, and also if you have advice for emerging women artists that you would like to share.
Yeah, so, well, I'm very excited about the journey I'm on right now. I think you know, the art world has definitely like slowed down, but I'm very grateful that things are still moving for me. I'm just really excited to just continue to explore. I'm still learning, evolving, and even now I'm exploring more of my Gambian identity. So some of the new backgrounds that I'm diving into are clear representation of that. So I'm playing around with architecture, like the European architecture, which is part of, you know, me identifying with that part, but also the Gambian landscapes and maybe some Gambian architecture or just West African architecture in general. I haven't decided yet, but definitely the landscape. So that's coming out of my new work and I'm really excited about that.
I'm excited too. Wonderful.
Yeah. And I would say my advice would be to ask questions. Like for me personally, in my journey, that was so helpful. I would just continuously ask questions. If there's something you don't know, don't worry about sounding stupid or thinking that this is something that you shouldn't be asking, or I don't know what the case is, but just ask questions. If you have questions, ask them. If you're trying to figure out how to maneuver in the art world, just ask. Ask anybody you know. If you want to be introduced to people, ask. Ask to be invited to things. I think one aspect of this world that I learned is that you do have to network a bit. And I'm not personally a person that likes to do that. I can be a little antisocial, introverted at times, and I just want to work. You know, I think most of us paint, we just want to work. Like, but you have to kind of put yourself out there a little bit too. So if you're not good at that, bring a friend, somebody that's extroverted, ask people to invite you. I think those are one of the main questions I've had from some, you know, artists that are trying to maneuver in this world, are new in this world, emerging just like me. Yeah, I've had those questions before, and those have been my main things that I say. You know, you have to talk to people and just ask questions. That's my main thing. Ask questions. It'll only be helpful.
Well, you have inspired me. Somebody's going to get asked a question today. I'm going to ask. After this, I'm going to be asking somebody to invite me to something, or I don't know. I'm going to figure it out, but I'm going to ask a question later today. Thank you so much, Rugi, Rugiatu Yalo, for being with me today and having this conversation. I'm super inspired and I'm loving following your work. I'm excited for what's coming up for you. And yes, and I hope to stay in touch. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much. And thank you for having me. Oh my God, this was really great. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you for joining us on this episode of Beyond Beauty. I've had a fascinating conversation with Rugiatu Yalo. Her insights into her self-taught techniques, her passion for painting women, and the influence of her Gambian and Swedish heritage on her work have been truly inspiring. Until next time, I encourage you to embrace the rich layers of beauty and the compelling stories that go beyond the surface. Stay curious and keep exploring the diverse narratives that make up the world of women in the arts. See you on the next episode.